This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this week's show, I have two top-level scientists for you. Pep Canadel, the director of the Global Carbon Project, reports a big increase in greenhouse gas emissions in 2018, mostly coming from China. We talk about whether even 2 degrees of warming is just a dream now. Dr. Jim Cossin of NOAA leads the climate reports for U.S. government and the IPCC. His specialty is big storms. His latest paper says they are slowing down and leaving a greater trail of destruction. This is your news before it's news on Radio EcoShock. With alarming new research, I've been saying that the dreaded 2 degrees C of warming is unlikely, even with geoengineering. So why are some officials still talking as though 1.5 degrees is the goal? Finally, I think more realism is emerging, partly due to stunning new emissions figures from China. Andy Pittman, director of the ARC Center for Excellence for Climate Extremes, told the Sydney Morning Herald newspaper, quote, "Most climate scientists think 2 degrees to be aspirational," end quote. While all industrial nations have failed to slash emissions, the story from China appears to be worse. We've reached Dr. Josep Canadel, known as PEP. He is the longtime executive director of the Global Carbon Project and a research scientist for the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or CSIRO, in Australia. PEP is an author in more than 150 peer-reviewed science papers and a member of the Nobel Prize-winning 2007 IPCC Fourth Assessment Report. From Canberra, Australia, PEP Canadel, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks. My pleasure to join you.
There was a lot of good news coming out of China over the past few years. Mass transit there is booming along with the world's largest solar buildup. We heard Chinese coal plants, the binge of building was ending. But what do actual emissions measurements tell us?
Well, I mean, I think that we had incredible good news over the past 3 years when we realized that China really peaked its coal emissions in 2013. And since then, those emissions have either kind of stabilized or going down. And so we had a very short period of great excitement. Now, the very latest peak into the energy consumption for the first 3 months of this year, coming straight from China statistics, are not looking great. So basically, the statistics are showing us that energy demand and therefore the carbon associated with most of the energy being based on coal, gas and oil will lead to higher emissions of these first 3 months than any other time we've seen in over the past 7 years. So that's not encouraging news. Even the statistics only refer to the first 3 months of the year.
Are we still dependent on reporting from each government, or is there an outside sort of scientific way to also measure the greenhouse gases?
So we do it two ways. So basically, most of the statistics are developed through the national reporting back to the UN, you know, statistic departments, and they kind of compile it all. There are other ways which are kind of more what we call top-down ways, where trade statistics of energy between countries and what is known as the production of the various countries kind of comes together in a few large bodies like BP and the International Energy Agency and some of our own emission work that we do in the Global Carbon Project. And these are kind of complementary. Sometimes they're kind of rougher. They're really good to understand the global emissions. But, of course, they're less good to kind of dive into details of each country. You really need to look at what the country reports are. And I might say very quickly that China's reporting has increased in quality tremendously over the last 10 years. They're doing a really accurate job at trying to get better and better all the time. So, yes, there's a lot of changes all the time, but there's a really good intent to do a good reporting.
Were you surprised by the growth of China's greenhouse gases recently, and do you think it's possible even the Chinese government was also surprised?
Well, we were surprised. I mean, we're surprised because we were so excited about, you know, we've been doing this work for decades, and, you know, the only thing you've seen over the decades is an acceleration of global carbon emissions. So we were very excited to see over the past previous 3 years, you know, this kind of a slowdown, largely but not exclusively coming from China, and the fact that it seemed not to be fully real or not sustainable, so that this year we're very likely to go up again. So last year emissions went up. China had a little increase, but it was a small one. So we still fell. Look, China has kind of mostly been stable for 3 years, now a fourth year. It just goes up a little, not a big deal. But yes, this year it just looks that that growth can be even bigger. So we are surprised. We're excited about global peak emissions. Peak emissions is a requirement, is an urgent requirement for almost any aspirations of low climate stabilization. So anything that has to do with, you know, 1.5, 2, and even, you know, a little more than 2 really requires that global carbon emissions peak like almost now and from forward begin to go down very quickly.
So we're going in the wrong direction still. And I thought that the big hydroelectric plants in China, like the Three Gorges, would help cut coal dependence. But there was a problem?
The problem is that China and globally, we're just asking for more and more energy. So the per capita energy demand is increasing. That is, the amount of energy that each person is consuming is going up. And also, the overall population is going up. So every year we have an increase in the energy demand that would need to be supplied exclusively by renewable energy so that we don't keep growing on emissions. And eventually, well, not eventually, very quickly, that renewable energy would need to be replacing, you know, the old fossil fuel infrastructure. Well, that's not happening. So what's happening is that, for instance, the last few years, we've seen growth in energy demand, and that growth in energy demand has been met by about 40% from renewable energy, which is extraordinary and unprecedented as well. But the rest of the 60% of the energy growth, you know, the demand growth, has been met with more fossil fuel emissions. And particularly natural gas and oil is really growing really fast and strong. Coal overall globally has a stabilized quite.
The United States and Europe, as you know, Pep, used to be the giants of carbon pollution. How much of the global total is now coming just from China?
Yeah, so about 27% and 7% from Europe and double of this from the U.S. So, yeah, so you have a steel now China, double than the next emitter, which is the U.S., and then U.S. being double of the conglomerate of European Union.
Well, you know, I'm in Canada, and Canadians are very high energy consumers, I have to say. And despite all the warnings from scientists and activists, we just haven't slashed our emissions. But what kind of cuts do we need from the original developed countries to make some room in that atmosphere for these other nations to grow?
Basically, globally, we should be decarbonizing completely our energy system, you know, by mid-century. This is an incredible feat, but, you know, one could argue there's no reason why technology can be accelerated, a big deal. We still have 30-plus years to go, so it's not totally out of this wall of possibilities. Now, in order to answer the question you're after, which is, well, sure, you know, we cannot be demanding the same from India and Africa in terms of emission cuts than we should ourselves, the kind of the richer, more developed world. And so that really puts the deadline for full decarbonization much earlier than mid-century, you know. And whether it's 2040 or it's earlier, I don't think that anyone has the clear numbers. But just keep in mind that probably by 2040, the developed countries would need to be fully decarbonized. And fully decarbonization doesn't mean zero carbon emissions. You know, we still can play with a few things that would allow to have, you know, some emissions, but not too many. It will be still a decarbonization of perhaps of 90% of the emissions. So we're really talking about a full transformation of the energy system. But then you could play with whatever, you know, natural carbon sinks, you know, forests and better management practices in the agricultural world, or, you know, slowing down deforestation and degradation. So there's a few tricks we can use, but these are small tricks. You still need to get rid of most of fossil fuel emissions, unless, and we've been talking about these unless for decades now. That's why it's almost embarrassing to be talking about, unless we make work carbon capture and storage, which is taking the emissions from any coal power plant or gas plant, and we burn, the fossil fuel, and we just capture all the carbon dioxide, and we send it straight into the geological strata to stay there forever. We do know now enough that this system could work. We know that they're expensive. We know that they need to improve. But, Canada is the one country in the world that has purposely built a carbon capture and storage facility associated to a coal power plant. And so, if we were to repeat this thing thousands and thousands of times across the globe, we could still think about, having perhaps some level of fossil fuel in our energy portfolio without the emission consequence.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Pep Canadel. He's the executive director of the Global Carbon Project. Now, in July 2011, there was a conference at the University of Melbourne titled 4 Degrees or More, Australia in a Hot World. The German climate scientist, Dr. Hans Schellenhuber, gave the keynote address, and we broadcast that on Radio EcoShock right away. And the mood then, Pepe, was what if? And now 4 degrees seems much more possible. Do you think scientists are moving along that continuum towards a world that could be much hotter than 2 degrees C?
So basically, I think that we need to kind of backtrack and think about, when we say about 2 degrees, I mean, who asked for the 2 degrees? So the 2 degree idea didn't necessarily came from the scientists. It came from policy. Originally came from the 90s, from the European countries, which they said globally we should stabilize climate at below 2 degrees because beyond then, because we think that is feasible and we can avoid the worst of climate change. But that was in the 90s. That's more than 20 years ago. And so here we are 20 years later. We've done very little other than grow emissions from greenhouse gases very fast, create a much bigger problem than ever we had. And we still are, hanging on the 2 degrees. So here's where, the problem comes from. And so the Paris Agreement, who now main goal is to stabilize the climate system below, 2 degrees from the industrial temperature. We are now so stuck with this kind of policy-driven 2 degrees that we had to invent new ways to actually, try to reach those 2 degrees. But this is just now a number of, we need to go beyond decarbonizing. We need to, go and start sucking up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere because decarbonizing the global energy system is just not enough. Now, can we still do the 2 degrees or are we really going well above and beyond? I mean, with our current emission trends and with what countries all over the world have committed to the Paris Agreement to do over the next 12 years to 2030, which is the first big commitment of the Paris Agreement, we know that it's not the kind of trend that is going to lead us to well below 2 degrees. So if we just look at where we are and what people are telling us they want to do for the next 10 years, 12 years, there's no way that then we can curve so quickly after that that we'll still be able to go 2 degrees. So we have already a huge problem just with what we are committed. Now, let's say we're going well past 2 degrees. I think that at this point, very likely, it's past 2 degrees. But I would say more than thinking that we may be going to the 4-degree arena, I'm not sure that we're going to go to the 4-degree arena. There's always surprises in their system. But from an emission point of view, I don't think that our economy and our society is going to be so stupid to kind of push the system and the economy to a point we're going to be cooking ourselves inside of it. I think that we're going to be much smarter, but, much smarter can be still be, well above 2 degrees, but without, I think, going to the extremes of 4 degrees that sometimes we have. Now, what's new, what I think that's new, is that we start seeing now some of the climate impacts coming already at 1 degree in ways that we didn't think quite they're going to come so early, or they're going to be so clearly distinctive at already 1 degree over industrial. So this is perhaps to me a much bigger worry than the worry that we're going to go beyond 2 degrees. 2 degrees, there's nothing magic about it. 2 degrees, there's plenty of impacts. And what we're now realizing is that that 2 degree has nothing of being a safe target. That's really the issue that's emerging now.
Yes, I have to tell you, at supposedly at 1 degree, yesterday I drove through a flooded out neighborhood right near me in southern British Columbia, and it was record floods. Everybody dragged everything they had out to the street. The houses had been condemned. They have to be torn down. Hardly anyone has insurance. Their lives are wrecked along with their homes. The local businesses may never return. So as we see emissions accelerating, I think there's a really good chance that well before we get to something like 3 degrees, the economy could collapse because we're just going to get beaten up by these extremes in climate change. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, look, I'm a person that believes that, yes, humans are stupid, but humans are also very smart, and they don't see it there as they see everything, you know, crumbling down. Now, the problem we always say on climate change is that, yes, you may decide that at some point into the near future that that's too much, and then it's too late. So because too late in the sense of the Earth system has a dynamics, that this is not like we just kind of pollute this area and now we're going to just pour the billions to kind of clean it up. No, it doesn't work this way with the planet. So the planet has its own dynamics. We need to understand them. We do understand them quite a bit. And certainly you need to start doing things well before you're in hot water. And so, yes, there is a risk that we're going to just go into hot water before being serious. But I think that you're totally right. I mean, we're going to see big impacts in the economy. There's no doubt about it. And I just want to tell you a little about even Australia, which I really think that Australia, by being in this kind of area between semi-arid and the subtropical, tropical belt, we're an incredible continent to actually show how a lot of the impacts will unfold in other parts of the world because we are really monitoring this thing very well. And I want to bring out a few examples, which all have, you know, huge economic implications. So, of course, the example everyone has heard is the Great Barrier Reef, where the last past extreme event of El Nino, which is condition when global temperatures kind of spike and then return back to a base. We had the most unprecedented coral bleaching ever recorded, to a point where, you know, literally a third of, and when I say a third of the Great Barrier Reef, means that 1,000 kilometers of coral reef, you know, had bleached at a very high level, up to 90%. I mean, unprecedented. The experts were saying you usually see the coral kind of starving when there's these episodes of, you know, hot water, and the starvation comes because the symbiosis that, you know, happens between the polyps and the green algae gets lost. The green algae disappears, and then the polyps starving because they don't have the carbohydrates that the algae give them. So they were saying that they've never seen a coral bleach, that there was no starvation. The coral just cooked. The temperatures were so high that in a week, literally, the bleaching just occurred. Usually bleaching occurs over many weeks as the corals are starving. So, I mean, this is unprecedented. And, you know, we have a $6 billion industry based on the Great Barrier Reef, from fishing to tourism. And, of course, people all around the world and tourism all around the world were talking about whether it was really worthwhile to go and visit the Great Barrier Reef again. So huge implications. In the north, we had something that has never been recorded in Australia and was equally unprecedented globally. 700 kilometers of mangrove in a few months died back. We've never seen any kind of dieback of mangrove regions so important, so extensive up in the north. And there's no record that this thing has ever happened anywhere else. And again, it happened because the water temperatures were so high, coming from relatively below average rainfall the previous month. And so altogether, literally obliterated 700. And these mangroves are really important places for all the fisheries of the tropical fish in the north, where the nurseries are really, you know, happening. So all these things, tremendous implications for the economy of Australia. And there's been a few other incredible examples. In the south, in Tasmania, we had fire. I mean, forest fires in places we've never seen fire. These are relict forests from the last glacial period, 10,000 years ago. There's never been a fire. There's peat soils, which they've been built over thousands of years. You know, this thing very well in Canada. And so there was a fire that literally obliterated in just a few days, but were a forest of pines, which were 1,000 years old. And these peatland soils, which they built over thousands of years, which also they were consumed incredibly quickly. So, I mean, these are total collapse of ecosystems, which cannot be recovered. You cannot recover a 1,000-year-old pine forest. You cannot recover multiple thousand-year development of a peat soil. So unprecedented, again, very related to the tourism industry of Tasmania, these alpine pristine forests. And so, again, we're seeing this thing at 1 degree. So I think that, you know, one needs to be start asking whether the 2 degree we talk so much has even been, you know, really a safe target in the first place.
Please tell us about the Global Carbon Project, what you do and why this project was put together in the first place.
Yeah, so the Global Carbon Project is a consortium of several hundred scientists all around the world looking at and putting together what we call the budgets of greenhouse gases, the carbon budget, the methane budget, the nitrous oxide budget. Budgets are important because they not only tell you, you know, how much carbon gets built into the atmosphere, which ultimately leads to climate change, but also tells you at a high resolution which sectors are contributing to those emissions. But in case of the carbon also, not all the carbon that we emit, actually only half of the carbon that we emit remains in the atmosphere and produce climate change. The other half gets absorbed by the oceans and absorbed by the vegetation around the world. So our role is also to really look very carefully the trends of carbon uptake in the ocean and on land, because if any of these trends were to change in the future, we would basically have a bigger fraction of the emissions staying in the atmosphere, leading to climate change. So we would be in accelerating mode. So the idea was to, because there were a lot of bodies doing various components, separate components of these carbon budgets and greenhouse budgets, we basically put the whole picture together, and we do it quite independently. It's a voluntary effort, and people contribute because they believe that what we're doing, it's of incredible value to the climate, you know, the climate convention, to society, and to basically into the discourse about climate change and what humans are doing to our planet. So we're totally independent, and we do these releases of measure information and data delivery for everyone to actually use, see, check, challenge. And so we try to also align a lot of our products to what, for instance, you know, the Paris Agreement may require to have to track and assess progress or otherwise, and also back to the nations to really say, you know, what do you need the most to try to understand, to make good judgments on the position of a particular country. So we try to develop a lot of national level information, both for carbon sinks and carbon sources. So countries have also additional data above and beyond the data from their own departments and agencies that they may want to use to build a case for action.
And do you produce an annual report, or do you have a more regular stream of data that goes out to countries? How does that work?
Yeah, so we do a major annual report every year, and so all the data gets updated. And also we provide something that's exceptionally valuable to almost everyone, and that is about the carbon emissions of the very year we're releasing the data. And we do this release just before the Convention on Climate meets. They meet once a year. Representatives of all countries come together. So during that big conference, we release the new data, and we tell both the national state representatives and, of course, to the rest of the world how well or bad we've done that very year in which we are. So we do a little bit also a projection just for the last few months of that year. And that's of incredible value, because this is almost immediate feedback to those people engaged in climate change action. And that includes both the governments and, of course, the NGO industries, who are all basically, you know, saying they want to do things. And we can provide almost instant feedback of what's happening in that area. Incredibly valuable. And so we're trying to just now bring other gases and kind of more comprehensive assessments to the availability of everyone.
Yes, I think what you just said is very important, too, because we're getting the picture of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and some people know the parts per million and so on. But methane is becoming more and more important, and you mentioned nitrous oxide, and there are other very rare greenhouse gases that are extremely powerful. It would be good if the public knew more about the broad index of all the greenhouse gases that are going to affect the climate.
Yes. So great point, and as I said, we're really working on this kind of more integrated package, but it's really important to understand that carbon dioxide, it's still not just quantitatively the most important gas, it's still the gas who ultimately will determine where we kind of stabilize the climate system. And the reason is that when you put like a ton of carbon dioxide, that ton of carbon dioxide, let's say that in about 100 years, about 60% of those emissions, so 600, if you put a ton, 600 kilos, will be removed from the atmosphere. And then you'll need 1,000 years more to remove the next 20. And then you need many thousands of years to remove the last 20, which means that a good part of the carbon that we put into the atmosphere, the carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere, it's there forever. Even if in the millennia scale gets ultimately removed and going into the ocean, of course, that's not a scale that is relevant to humanity. We still want to be here in 1,000 years, but surely, you know, for the actions we need to take and the care we need to take for our next generations, carbon dioxide, it's almost like, it's an irreversible emission to some extent. That's why we put so much emphasis on CO2, not just because, whatever, carbon is cooler than methane or N2O. And yes, the other ones, they continue to go up, and we do need to deal with them. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But as I said, in the long horizon, let's say, you know, over the next 100 years, can we stabilize 2 degrees or 2.5 or 1.5? Carbon dioxide is the one that dictates the most, you know, what's possible and what's not possible, because it's that irreversibility nature, almost irreversibility nature of it.
You know what? I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, and I'm nobody to disagree. But the thing is, you just talked about very extreme things that had happened in Australia that had not been seen before and that can't be reversed. And they happened in a pretty short period of time. So if we have a burst, say, of methane, and let's say methane only really stays very active for 10 or 12 years in the atmosphere, in that 10 or 12 years, we may suffer extreme damage. So it does matter, too, what happens in the short term, I think.
Of course. And again, and the burst, it would need to be a burst which is kind of a planetary type of thing, that like a runaway big permafrost thawing, which currently we don't think that's going to happen. So, yes, you're right in the sense that there are surprises there. We should not pretend, you know, we understand everything about the dynamics of the Earth system. That would be just plain wrong. And that in the historical period of millions of years ago, there's been a few bursts of methane, geological methane, which led to rapid increases of temperature. But again, it is part of this kind of surprise, you know, that currently methane comes from livestock, rice. You know, we understand that we're eating more and more meat, and that rice paddies are quite as stable now for quite a few decades. So we have a sense of how this is going to evolve into the future. Now, I'm going to put a caveat here. Wetlands. Wetlands are natural emitters of methane. And of course, as we change the climate, warmer wetlands, not dry wetlands, but warmer wetlands, if they're still wet, will release more methane. So we know that, because every time that there is these El Niño conditions, which brings global temperatures higher for a year or less than 2 years, we know and we observe and we measure increases in methane from wetlands, particularly in the tropics, more than in the high latitudes, like in Canada. But of course, as the climate warms, over the coming many decades, we will see most likely higher increases. Now, is this big enough to kind of change completely our numbers for where we're going? And maybe not completely, because we're counting on some of these things, but there could be surprises that we don't have a handle on the whole dynamics of the Earth as we would love to have.
I really appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion with you. We have been speaking with Dr. Pep Cannadel. He's the executive director of the Global Carbon Project, and he's a research scientist, and I hope you're still finding some time to do your research along with this huge project. People can tune in to this whole thing at globalcarbonproject.org, and I will put links to the news stories and reports we have talked about in my weekly show blog posted at ecoshock.org. Pep Cannadel, I know you're crazy busy. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Incredible pleasure to speak with you.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
From Texas to Taiwan, slow-moving hurricanes have caused record damage. Has something changed in the way these big storms work? Four well-known climate scientists are asking, does global warming make tropical cyclones stronger? Dr. Jim Cawson is an atmospheric research scientist. He's with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. Jim is currently a lead author on the U.S. Global Change Research Program for their fourth national assessment. He's also working on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change sixth assessment report. Jim has won awards, and the key science he publishes is used by world climate researchers and meteorologists. He's just published an important paper in the journal Nature. Let's get talking. From his base in Madison, Wisconsin, Jim Cawson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to connect with you. So your paper published June 6, 2018 in Nature, I'll give listeners the title, A Global Slowdown of Tropical Cyclone Translation Speed. Now, before we can talk about these most damaging storms in the world, we have to clear up two terms. First, are hurricanes and tropical cyclones the same thing?
Yes, they are. Tropical cyclones is the most generic way that we can describe them. The difference between hurricane and typhoon is just a regional description of them, but they're all the same animal.
Good deal. Now, what do storm scientists mean by translation speed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So everyone knows that these storms spin very rapidly. That's where they become so dangerous. So we would call that their rotation speed. But in addition to spinning, they also move along in the currents of background wind. So translation speed is just simply the speed at which they move from one point to another along the planet's surface.
All right. Now, my American listeners are most familiar with Hurricane Harvey. It hit Houston and the Texas coast in late August 2017. Harvey is tied with Hurricane Katrina as the most costly in U.S. history. Could Hurricane Harvey be a certain case study for your new research?
Oh, I think so. And there have been a number of case studies that have gone in and tried to figure out if there's any connection to Harvey's very slow movement and some of the larger climate changes that we've observed. I view it in terms of my work as being a very good example of what a slow storm can do. And my results are, I like to think of them in the broader context of, in general, around the planet, these storms are slowing down.
But what made you ask the questions, have hurricanes or cyclones slowed down?
Yeah, interestingly, it wasn't really Hurricane Harvey, although I'm sure that was in my subconscious. What motivated the work was that there's been a number of papers that have looked at how anthropogenic global warming has affected the general atmospheric circulation, both the patterns and the strength. And it's kind of that classic, everything looks like a nail to a guy with a hammer. I think of things in terms of how they might affect tropical cyclones because that's what I specialize in. So after becoming fairly well-versed in the background literature on these changes, I said, well, if the flow is changing, then we should see that in the way the tropical cyclones are moving around the planet because they're fairly passive. They're just carried along in it.
In 2011, I covered Hurricane Irene, which wasn't all that strong by the time it hit New England, but it dumped incredible amounts of rain, and it kept going for several days, just sort of stuck there, and caused widespread flooding and damage more than expected. But isn't that partly because a warmer atmosphere holds more water?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's two relatively independent factors here that are going to increase local rainfall. One of them is the actual rain rate, which is if you just move with the storm and measure the rate at which water is coming out of them, that's expected to increase simply by virtue of the fact that we're warming the air, and warmer air can hold more water vapor, and more water vapor means more rain. So that's a given. We have a lot of confidence in that. But really, independent of that is this idea of translation speed. Because whatever the rain rate is, whether it's increasing or not, if you slow the storm down, you're going to get a lot more rain in any local area. So it's the two things acting in concert that really is creating a potential for a really highly increased risk.
Okay, so I looked up a list of the wettest tropical cyclones in the science reference for the rest of us, Wikipedia, and Taiwan got 8 of the top 25 wettest storms, and one of them in 2009 was Typhoon Morakot, which dumped over 3,000 millimeters of rain. That's 120 inches, or 10 feet of rain from one storm. How did your long-term study find for the Northwest Pacific? Did you find changes for that?
Yes, and unfortunately, the Northwest Pacific is kind of ground zero for the signal that I found. It's much larger there. The global slowdown is about 10%. The basin-wide Atlantic slowdown is about 6%. And the slowdown in the western North Pacific, we're getting up closer to 30%. And these slowdowns are also noted to be very strong over land, which is, of course, where we're most concerned with.
And speaking of overland, we had Cyclone Yasi hitting Queensland and the coast of Australia in February 2011. But that one continued pretty far inland, and it caused over $800 billion of damage. Is that another case from your study?
All of these cases are included, and they all contribute to the signal that I'm finding in a more global average sense. When we drill down into these particular regions, we find the slowing to be occurring everywhere except for the Northern Indian Ocean, which is always a bit of an outlier because it's so small and it's so land-constrained. And there's not a whole lot of storms that occur there, although the ones that do can be very dangerous. But the point being that this seems to be consistent everywhere, and I find strong signals in the region around Australia just as I find them in the region around Taiwan.
And you also, though, found that there was a change in the overland translation of these storms.
That's right, yeah. I mean, and again, that's where we're most concerned. I mean, how much local rainfall these storms drop over the ocean is of academic interest, but it's not very relevant to society. So I looked specifically at how the storms were moving over land, and there's very strong slowdown signals found there as well.
And how does a change in the movement of tropical cyclones or hurricanes affect damage to the coastline and buildings?
Yeah, that's another very unfortunate aspect of this signal that I found in terms of the impacts of tropical cyclones. First of all, in its broadest sense, I like to say that tropical cyclones, whatever they bring with them to your neighborhood, will last longer if they're moving slowly. So that can't be good. But specifically, the three main factors we think about that are highly hazardous would be the wind, and then there's the storm surge, which is more that salt water flooding that occurs at and near the coast, and then there's the freshwater flooding that can occur everywhere, including fairly far inland. So all three of those things are expected to increase when these tropical cyclones slow down. The local rain is the simplest one to understand. The slower storms drop more rain on you. The storm surge is slightly harder to understand, but there's a lot of evidence to suggest that if the storm is moving slowly, it pushes a larger wall of water in front of it, and that is what the storm surge is. And then finally, the wind hazard. We know that wind speed is going to affect how much damage is done to structures, but also duration. The longer that wind blows against the structure, the more damage it will do, and the more likely that structure is to fall down. So all three of the main hazards associated with these storms would be amplified by this slowdown signal I found.
And then we have the so-called tertiary hazards like higher food prices or waterborne diseases. And as we see in Puerto Rico still, it can take a long time to rebuild. Do the slower moving storms add to those hazards as well?
I think they would. I mean, those hazards are mostly based on the amount of damage incurred when a storm makes landfall, and a slowdown would increase all of those. It would increase the wind damage, it would increase the saltwater flooding damage, and it would increase the freshwater flooding damage. So it would certainly contribute to what we're finding in Puerto Rico.
Well, Jim Cawson, we've had all this storm talk without really asking the trillion-dollar question. You discovered a measurable slowdown in the movement of tropical cyclones, but is it due to climate change?
Yeah, and that is the million-dollar question. My particular study was strictly empirical, which is to say that I just documented what we've observed over the last 70 years. The idea of finding a relationship between that and human-caused climate change would require a more dedicated and careful study where we can sort of disentangle all the contributing factors to that slowdown. There's unquestionably a contribution of natural variability in it, and there's very likely to be a contribution from human-caused factors. The challenge now will be to disentangle those two things. And what's interesting is, so I found a 10% slowdown. It's quite possible that the human-caused factor is a small fraction of that, maybe just a few percent. But it's also equally possible that it's greater than 10, because natural variability can act to offset a signal or to compound a signal. So at this point, it's really a very important question that we need to answer. But the evidence points to a human fingerprint on this signal that I found, if for no other reason than it's behaving in a way consistent with what we would expect due to human-caused changes. And it's also a fairly long-term time series that we're looking at, that we found a trend. The longer the time series we have, the more confident we are that this has to do with greenhouse gases.
What you just said reminds me totally of my discussion in 2012 with Rutgers scientist Jennifer Francis. I asked her about a theory that she was publishing about disappearing sea ice and changes to the jet stream, and she corrected me and said, well, her paper wasn't theoretical. It was a report about observations, and those were time-concurrent events, but the link wasn't really known yet. Is that a similar situation?
Yes, it is. It is. And in order to really answer that question in a formal quantitative sense, you have to have a dedicated study, and it would be what we would call a detection and attribution study. Now, there's a number of ways that you can do those studies, but in general, what we want to do is we want to be able to check this behavior in a world where there is no anthropogenic effects, and then we want to compare it to what we have when we add those effects. And then we can start to really separate out just how much one thing is related to another.
In a separate publication, Jim Cawson, you and Kerry Emanuel, Stefan Ramsdorf, and Michael Mann published a post in the Real Climate blog titled, Does Global Warming Make Tropical Cyclones Stronger? What is the gist of that argument?
Well, I think that the gist of that argument is that we just keep on adding to our body of evidence that the kinds of intensities that we're measuring now are out of the ordinary. They're unlike what we've measured before. The biggest challenge we face when we make that statement is that not only are we observing the storms to be behaving differently, but the way we observe them has changed. And this is actually problematic because it becomes a little bit harder for us to understand how much of what we're seeing is due to the fact that we have such better technology versus how much is an actual physical change. But that particular, and I would call that a blog post rather than an article, only because it's not a peer review. It's more of a an informal discussion of this is what we know, and this seems to be what it's telling us. We're seeing behaviors that are consistent, again, with what we understand in terms of the theory of tropical cyclones, and also consistent with what we are finding when we model these with numerical simulations. The idea, again, being that we're finding all of these very, very strong tropical cyclones just in the last decade or so.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. With me is Dr. Jim Cawson, the well-known atmospheric research scientist with NOAA. We are talking about the new science of superstorms. Jim, the Real Climate blog post says your group of four expects, quote, the strongest future storms will exceed the strength of any in the past. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, that has to do with the idea that as you warm the planet, you increase the maximum intensity they can achieve. There actually is a speed limit on these storms, and that speed limit is set by the details of the atmosphere and ocean. And you could even take that one step further. It's the atmosphere and ocean in any given place at any given time. So the speed limit that is being set by, say, the sea surface temperatures, the ocean warmth, and, say, the behavior of the atmosphere above it, if we warm the atmosphere, that simply raises that speed limit. And then the next step that we take in the argument is if you increase the speed limit, storms will reach it. They will find it. You know, they'll be in a perfect situation. Confounding factors will be minimized. They won't interact with land, and they can achieve that maximum. So if the maximum itself is increasing, then we expect the maximum actual intensity of these storms to start going beyond anything we've seen before.
Right, and some scientists, including Michael Mann, are calling for a new higher rating for hurricanes or cyclones, Category 6 storms. What do you think?
Well, I think that there's a number of very good arguments for why you would do that, and there's some arguments for why it may not be a good idea. It almost is more of a social science question than a physical science question at this point. I mean, one argument that I've heard that would go against it is human nature would right now would say, okay, there's a Category 5 heading towards us, and then everyone's preparing for this Category 5, and then it gets downgraded to a Category 4, and people maybe stop taking it quite as seriously, even though a Category 4 storm is a very, very dangerous storm. So that's an oddness of human behavior, I think. And if we have a Category 6, I guess one concern could be that people won't take Category 5 as seriously as they should. Now, whether that's a good enough reason to not add a category, again, I think that that's a question that needs to be discussed, not just among scientists, but also among social scientists, and whether it needs to be discussed among forecasters who are putting the warnings and messages out, or city emergency planners. All of these people with their ideas should come into the argument.
Let's get back to your new paper just published in Nature. Do you know why you found such large changes in storm movement in the Northern Hemisphere rather than in the tropics or in South America?
I'm not really sure, no. I know that it's not at all uncommon for longer-term variability and trends to be quite different between the two hemispheres. They are different just in terms of the fact that the Southern Hemisphere is almost entirely water. There's a lot less land, and so the whole circulation patterns are different there. There's also the possibility that data issues are more likely to creep into my analysis in the Southern Hemisphere rather than the Northern Hemisphere, simply because so much of the data is taken from way out over open water versus maybe a little closer to land in the Northern Hemisphere. So there's a number of things that could feed into that, and I really don't know the answer to that. It's something that hopefully we'll look at a little bit more carefully.
Our friend Jeff Masters from the Weather Underground adds this question for you, Jim. Do you have any speculation why the slowdown is so much greater over land than water for the Atlantic?
Yeah, I have speculation, but I haven't looked into it to get a more definitive answer to that. The speculation at this point would be that most of the motion of these hurricanes in the Atlantic are driven by the Bermuda High, which is a large pressure system that sits off in the open Atlantic there, not too far from Bermuda. And it's a persistent feature in the summertime when we have all these tropical cyclones. And basically what it does is it steers the storms to move from east to west down in the tropics and sometimes brings them northward, which we call recurvature. So the effects of the steering flow from the Bermuda High are generally constrained to be stronger over the open water. And so the storms that are actually interacting with land, I think just by default, are further away from that pressure system. And so they may actually be affected by other factors.
You know, as a climate reporter, I recall at least three cases of drought lasting several years, then broken up by storms with extreme rainfall. And I'm not even talking about California. Texas had several years of drought before Harvey. I was reporting on terrible drought in central North Africa when the story changed to massive floods in the same place. And then we had a long drought in Australia followed by epic flooding from storms. Do you think, Jim, that these swings could be part of the more extreme weather predicted by climate scientists?
Well, I think it certainly could. It certainly fits the bill, yes. I mean, in addition to trends and just sort of the average behavior of these extreme events, we would also quite often see changes in the amount of variability that they go through. So, yeah, that would certainly be, again, consistent with what could be affected by human causes.
What does it mean that you found, quote, evidence that tropical cyclones have migrated poleward in several regions, and how does the slowdown found in your paper intersect with the trend for tropical cyclones at more poleward latitudes?
Yeah, the idea of the migration away from the tropics and towards the middle latitudes was from a paper that we'd published in 2014, and that was also another signal that we were somewhat surprised by. So the key thing that happens there is these storms are hitting their peak intensity at higher and higher latitudes, which may be considered good news for places closer to the deep tropics because they might start to see fewer of these peak intensities in their neighborhood, but it's certainly bad news for areas away from the tropics. That, in terms of human impact, what it does is it changes the patterns of risk exposure. So places that didn't used to see quite so many of these events will start to see more. And in terms of how that would be considered along with the slowing signal of this more recent paper, I think that they both would contribute and compound each other in terms of how risks and patterns of risk are being changed. So places that are maybe more used to these hazards become less exposed to them, while places that aren't quite as used to them will start to become more exposed to them.
And here's another known unknown raised by this new research. Jim Cawson, what is a stalled track and what do we need to know?
Yeah, there actually isn't a formal definition of that. It's more of a colloquialism at this point, but it's used with some regularity. And I've just thought about it in terms of that classic expression when Justice Potter Stewart was asked to define pornography. He said, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. And that seems to be sort of the case here with stalled storms. When it happens, we say, well, that's a stalled storm. So we need to just get in there and make a formal definition. But the shorter answer to your question is that the stalled storm will typically involve either a slowing down to the point where it just hangs around an area for days, but it could also include a change in its track so that maybe it loops around an area. Or in the case of Harvey, both things happened because it was traveling very, very slowly. And not only that, but it hit a sort of a westernmost point, and then it stopped and turned around and went back the way it came. So the areas along that track were not only subjected to a very slow track, but they were subjected to it twice. So that would be a classic example of a stalled track, but at this point we really do need to better define what that means.
So you found increases in slow-moving storms, but that doesn't mean we still won't get fast-moving cyclones and hurricanes that don't fit this pattern.
Oh, absolutely. Right. This is an average behavior. And how we measure that average could be anyway. We could do it the way I did it, which is just to look at the average speed of each storm and then look at how the average speeds are each year and then look at how that varies over time. Another way to look at it might be to set some kind of a threshold and then say, what is the frequency of storms that are, quote-unquote, stalled? But they both say the same thing. But that certainly doesn't mean that we're not going to have very fast-moving storms. And that would be true of most of these climate-related signals that we find. They're not always just moving in one direction.
How does your research help us plan for future stress and adaptation?
Well, I'd like some of these signals to go into risk modeling. That's a separate business that I interact with people who do that, but I don't do it myself. But I think that's really what we need to do, and that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. So if we can run these into catastrophe models and risk models and get a better sense of how this is changing exposure and risk given the various vulnerabilities of the different areas, then that will give the information, the valuable information to the people who are making these plans. So whether that's a city planner trying to figure out, you know, what the dike system should look like in their city, or whether it's a construction company trying to figure out how to make wind-resistant structures along the coast, or any of a number of those things, then they really need this sort of information in terms of how the risks have changed and how we might expect them to change in the future.
Final question. I've just spoken with Pep Cannadel from the Global Carbon Project. He has bad news about increasing greenhouse gas emissions now in 2018, especially from China. What about you, Jim Cawson? Do you think humans can still leave a livable climate to our grandchildren, or have we gone too far too fast?
Oh, boy. Well, I certainly think that we're making it more and more challenging every day and every year where we don't make more significant changes in how we use the resources we have. I don't ever want to say that we've gone too far and we throw up our hands and give up, but we certainly have not been responding to these alarming alerts and red flags in a way that is very encouraging in terms of how quickly these changes are going to occur. But I think sea changes are in the air, if you'll pardon that strange connection there. I see that there's various oil companies that are now freely saying, yes, we think that climate change is caused by humans. We don't feel that we're liable for it, but we agree that it's caused by humans. So that's a sea change. We also are seeing financial groups and shareholders that are insisting that these companies have climate resiliency plans. So it's no longer a question of, is climate change real and are we causing it? And that's just a given. Now they're saying, what are you going to do about it? How are you going to protect our assets in the face of climate change? So I think that these evolving changes in terms of the way society at large is thinking about climate change, I think that's going to eventually bring us to a place where we stop arguing about whether it's real, and then we can all kind of put our shoulders to the wheel and get busy on how to mitigate these issues.
Dr. Jim Cawson is an atmospheric researcher. He's led top-level reports on climate change for the American government and the team of international scientists, the IPCC. His latest paper, A Global Slowdown of Tropical Cyclone Translation Speed, was published in the journal Nature on June 6th. You can find links to all of the science and the news we've discussed in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Jim Cawson, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Well, thank you. It was really a pleasure to talk to you.
My thanks to all the listeners who support this program and the nonprofit stations that bring out the voice of science on Radio EcoShock. Join us again next week.